please join me in welcoming Jim Henkin to introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Kendall. Hello, everyone. Without wanting to take anything away from Charles Darwin and his ideas, I feel obliged to point out that publication of his Origin of Species is not the only important 150th anniversary that we celebrate this year. For 1859 also is the year in which the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology was founded by the Swiss paleontologist Louis Agassiz. It's one of the wonderful coincidences in the history of evolutionary biology that in the same year as the publication of The Origin, Louis Agassiz founded and began directing the MCZ in large part to ultimately obtain evidence that would disprove Darwin. Ironically, at least for Agassiz, the MCZ went on to become one of the world's leading centers for study and training in evolutionary biology. And for this reason, we are pleased to co-sponsor the 150th anniversary Origin of Species lecture series, beginning with tonight's lecture by Everett Mendelsohn. Everett Mendelsohn is professor emeritus in the history of science and research professor of the history of science here at Harvard, where he has served on the faculty since 1960. He has worked extensively on the history of the life sciences, as well as on aspects of the social and sociological history of science and the relations of science and modern societies. Indeed, he is widely regarded as one of the founders of the field of social history of science. Everett is the founder and former editor of the Journal of the History of Biology and a founder of the yearbook Sociology of the Sciences, and he has served on numerous editorial boards. He's past president of the International Council for Science Policy Studies and has been deeply involved in the relations between science and modern war as a founder of the American Association for the Advancement of Science's Committee on Science, Arms Control, and National Security, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Committee on International Security Studies. He was a founder and first president of the Cambridge-based Institute for Peace and International Security. Prior to his official retirement, Professor Mendelsohn taught a large undergraduate course as part of Harvard's core curriculum, which focused on science and society in the 20th century. Recognized as a brilliant teacher, he was awarded the Phi Beta Kappa Teaching Prize in 1996, and in 2002, the Harvard Graduate Student Council Mentoring Award was renamed in his honor. We are honored to have him present this lecture on The World Before Darwin to the audience here tonight, as well as to those joining us from across the country and around the world. Professor Mendelsohn.
Thank you very much, Jim, for those warm words. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Darwin be, and all was light. Some of you will recognize that I somewhat borderized that couplet by Alexander Pope. He was celebrating Isaac Newton. But we're celebrating Darwin this year, this 150th anniversary of the origin and the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth. In a sense, we can replace, substitute, and exchange Darwin and Newton. In some ways, they bracket British history of science. Charles Darwin marked the end of an epoch, as did Isaac Newton. Also, each of them represented the opening of a new epoch. In looking at the world before Darwin, that is, the world before the origin, I will not search for precursors. But I will want to ask, what could Darwin know from that world? What was at hand? What were the contexts in which he worked? Let me begin briefly alluding to that world in which Darwin worked. The fact is that we're affecting the world into which he came. Rapid changes in population, the improvement and the breakdown in transportation, the changes in the way the majority of people earn their living, all of these dramatically shifting during the early 19th century. Cities grew and towns grew. London in 1801 had 957,000 residents. By 1851, it had 2,300,000, a growth of 2.5 times. Bradford in the new northern Midlands of England. In 1801, had 13,000 people. In 1851, had 104,000, a multiple of 8.5 in its size. Other cities and towns grew 3, 4, 5 times in that half a century. Change was everywhere, and people felt the sense of dislocations of a good deal of that change. An industrial revolution began in the late 18th century and into the 19th century. And the French Revolution tore apart the continent and launched wars across Europe. Radical notions were introduced, the rights of man, the sovereignty of people. These became part of what were being talked about. What emerged was a manufacturing bourgeoisie as the dominant class, replacing the aristocracy and the landed gentry. The heroes of this new class were Adam Smith, Thomas Robert Malthus, Jeremy Bentham. They were committed to a new way of making goods, and they were committed to new ways of thinking about the world, including the spiritual world. There was a rise in evangelical Christianity as compared to the Anglican world. Their aim was to make Britain the workshop of the world, their words, to introduce free trade, to maximize profits to themselves, to end the lingering political controls and the domination of an aristocracy through parliamentary and local government reform, to achieve full control over labor, hiring, firing, at all, by warding off workers' organizations and other blocks to free trade. They wanted to expand their world, as they did, to an empire in which the sun never set. Exploration was forced, and indeed Darwin was part of that explanatory world. And war. England was almost continuously at war from 1793 to 1815. England's led across the battlefield, as well as in the textile mills and the iron foundries. These were the changes which were to shape the way in which the young Darwin came into the world. Something of the shift that was occurring was caught in those romantic words of William Blake, the poet, in the beginning of the 19th century. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the Holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pasture seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mills? Bringing my bow of burning gold, bringing my arrows of desire, bringing my spear, O clouds unfold, bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease to mourn from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. In a sense, the last gasp of a pastoral and romantic vision, which was to be replaced and was being replaced all around of those who were able to read Blake and either mourn with him or jeer at his strange image. What was this world before Darwin? Well, really, in some ways, it's the world before The Origin of Species, published by Darwin in 1859. On the origin of species by means of natural selection or the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life, to give it its full title, Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. But a brief other Darwinian diversion, Erasmus Darwin, the grandfather of Charles, born in 1731, died in 1802. He was a man of these new classes from the Midlands and the north of England, not from London. He went to Edinburgh for his medical training. He was a man of the Enlightenment and a supporter of the French Revolution at a time when England feared the implications of those revolutionary movements. Added to the French scholars of his day, the Enlightenment philosophers, the Enlightenment literary figures. Probably Erasmus Darwin was an atheist. He was certainly a materialist. He believed in electricity as a solver of problems. The nervous fluid in the body was electric in nature. He conducted galvanic experiments, which influenced Mary Shelley's Frankenstein as she picked up these ideas. He was an inventor, a poet, a naturalist, author of Botanic Garden, Loves of Plants, Temple of Nature, Zoonomia. His image was quite clear. Life began in tiny filaments and grew to achieve a capability of irritability. In his Temple of Nature, he celebrates some of this. Organic life beneath the shoreless waves was born and nursed in ocean's pearly caves. First forms minute, unseen by spheric glass, move on the mud or pierce the watery mass. These successive generations bloom, new powers acquire, and larger limbs assume. When countless groups of vegetation spring, and breathing realms of fin and feet and wing. An image to which the young Darwin, his grandson, who never knew him, would feel quite at home with. Perhaps all the productions of nature, Erasmus wrote, are in their progress to greater perfection, an idea countenanced by the modern discoveries and deductions concerning the progressive formation of the solid parts of the terraqueous globe and consonant to the dignity of the creator of all things. An image, then. Development from the very, very simplest to us, and a progression in direction. The poetic vision was there. But my point here is not precursorship, because that's not what Erasmus Darwin is doing, but rather Erasmus Darwin was part of a common discourse of the late 18th and early 19th century. In the face of the orthodoxy of a static nature, Dane design, you see a watch and you know there's a watchmaker. William Paley attacked Erasmus Darwin. He sees Erasmus atheism, materialism. He wanted to substitute something new, a natural theology. Not theology based on nature, but seeing in nature the attributes of the deity. An idea which, in a sense, was to be put in juxtaposition to the new views of the naturalist explanation versus the religious or theological explanation. Let me move on. Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, born in 1744 in France, is a slightly younger contemporary of Erasmus Darwin. He knew Erasmus Darwin's writings and cites them. But there's a Lamarck problem for historians of science. In part, Lamarck was demolished in the eulogy given him by Georges Cuvier, his somewhat younger French successor, a figure of the establishment. Cuvier was politically well-connected and, in a sense, was a man of the post-revolution, the Napoleonic eras. And the Darwinians, post-1859, had to critique and replace Lamarck. Why? Because they were replacing his explanation of how change occurred in nature with a new George Darwinian, a new Darwinian explanation, Charles Darwinian explanation of what it was that nature was about. And there were the political problems that Lamarck was beset with. He did indeed believe in the inheritance of characteristics acquired through the impact of the environment upon organisms. Paul Camara, in the 1920s, researched on the midwife toad and displayed, he believed, the inheritance of acquired characteristics. He was being Lamarckian. Fraud was claimed. Camara committed suicide. Indeed, we know his political sympathies. Camara had planned to go and establish a school in Moscow in those years after the revolution. But then there is that follower, Lysenko, Trofim Denisovich Lysenko, in the late 1930s through 1948, when Lysenkoism became the official mode of inheritance based, Lysenko said, directly on Lamarck, the inheritance of acquired characteristics. Lamarck, in a sense, was pushed aside and buried for many in the later generations, not in the period of Darwin himself or even immediately after. Some strong Lamarckians were right here at the Museum of Comparative Zoology at the end of the century. Lamarck has been rescued by more recent scholars in the United States, France, Britain, and Italy. The question, was Lamarck important? Can we understand the history of evolution without him? What did he really do? Where does he fit? He was a late 18th century scientist who lived into the 19th century. In some ways, he lived and operated at the margins. He was a materialist in the French late 18th century Enlightenment tradition. He survived the revolution and indeed found a place in the new reorganized of French scientific world. He was part of the lesser nobility, but he sympathized with the revolution rather than turning against it. Jean-Baptiste Pierre-Antoine de Monet de Lamarck gives you an indication of who the man was, but he was really marginal to power in the old France and in some ways not too close to it in the new. He worked at the new Museum of Natural History in Paris. He'd begun as a botanist, but he turned to invertebrate zoology. And I note the change here in a way because I think it helps explain in part who he was and what he was able to do. In the latter field, he became interested in transformism. His shift in fields was in part the equivalent of a voyage of discovery, meeting new signs, new symbols, a new nature that he hadn't studied previously. He had some wacky ideas as well, in chemistry particularly. But on the other hand, chemistry was key to his system. He was a materialist, and he based his nature on material things. He wrote a book, Hydrology, 1799, published over a couple of years in 1802. All of nature, he wrote in this book, works in accord with the same principles. All of nature works in accord with the same principles. There are natural tendencies and forces which produce a gradual change over long periods of time. Water, heat, fluids acting on the surface of the earth, which is what have brought about the changes on the nature of the earth. Charles Darwin, I quote for a moment, "The belief that species were immutable productions was almost unavoidable as long as the history of the world was thought to be of short duration." Natural forces acting on the surface of the earth over long periods of time was what Lamarck pushed as his view. He engaged in a vast effort of collection of fossils at the Jardin. Others were bringing them in. What these fossils, he said, told him was that the earth was older than had previously been thought. And he reflected here on the materialist philosophy of the Baron d'Holbach, on the effects of everyday processes acting over a long period of time. Lamarck enunciated a uniformitarian principle. I'm not sure who put these words up, but they were clear. Nature was generous of time and parsimonious of violence. This was the view that emerged in reading of Lamarck. Lamarck gave up the immutability of species sometime between April 1799 and early 1800. In 1800, he opened a course of lectures on the invertebrates. He saw a graduated series, a great chain of being. He saw decay and degeneration in these series and a diminution of animal faculties. He notes the adaptation of birds to environmental circumstances. Nature, he said, after forming the simplest elements through spontaneous generation, he believed, possibly, produced all others. I would prove that it is not the form of the body or its parts that engenders animal habits and modes of life, but that, on the contrary, it is the modes of life and all influencing circumstances which over time have shaped animal bodies and parts. New forms have enabled the acquisition of new faculties, and little by little, nature has reached the state in which we may see it today. Circumstance. Physical needs, new responses, new habits, and in turn, these strengthen certain parts of the organ and the organs through use, and others diminish through non-use. These changes, he believed, were passed on through reproduction. In 1802, he publishes his Recherche sur l'organisation des corps vivants, researches on the organization of living beings. And he develops the idea more fully. He explicitly adopts spontaneous generation. Why does he go after spontaneous generation, something which was to be ridiculed somewhat later? He needed a mechanism for change. He didn't want to leave it to something out there. You needed something which you could see happening in material form. The natural tendency toward greater complexity, which he saw in nature, he believed fits with this notion of there being a long time. Heat and electricity could make life, he believed, and therefore he came to believe that it did make life. You didn't need scriptures. You ceded to nature the explanation of how life came into being and how it developed. Ascend, he wrote, from the simplest to the most complex. Leave from the simplest animalcule and go up the long scale of the animal to the animal richest in organization and faculties. Conserve everywhere the order of relation in these masses. Then you will have hold of the true thread that ties together all of nature's productions. You will have a just idea of her marche, and you will be convinced that the simplest of her living productions have successively given rise to all others. The lateral ramifications, species in general, emerge in this form, under particular circumstances, a physical environment affecting them. He even tries to explain humans in this way. How? As a materialist, the nervous system. And what made the nervous system work? These electrical fluids, which were so much a part of the new experiments in the early years of the 19th century. In 1809, he published his Philosophie Zoologique, and here he provided his fullest early explanation of transformism, the diversity from two processes. He went beyond the 1802 volume, and in part three, he talked about how it was that things emerged, including higher mental faculties. And he ties it all to structural developments of the nervous system. The state, he says, in which we now see all the animals is, on the one hand, the product of the increasing composition of organization, which tends to form a regular gradation, and on the other hand, that of the influences of a multitude of very different circumstances that continually tend to destroy the regularity and the gradation of the increasing composition of organization. There we have the two forces at work, the new coming into being and things being destroyed by the physical environment in which they lived. I can't close without just a few other words from Lamarck's entry, L'Homme, in the Nouveau Dictionnaire d'Histoire Naturelle. By an egoism too short-sighted for its own good, for his own good, by a lack of concern for the future and welfare of his fellow men, man seems to work for the annihilation of his means of conservation and the destruction of his own species. And he goes on at some length to talk about this strange thing that humans have done in which they engage in the destruction of the world about them, which they depend on for their own continued existence. In 1814, a book was published, Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation. Publisher John Churchill, of London, a fairly well-known publishing house. Scan the title page. There's no author's name. It was anonymously published. The author we knew later, much later officially, was Robert Chambers from Edinburgh, who with his brother William Chambers were publishers. The Biographical Dictionary, eminent Scotsman, Chambers, and Edinburgh Journal, a weekly, which had some 50,000 copies being sold regularly. He was part of the Edinburgh Enlightenment. He was part of the advances that came with the cheap steam press. And Edinburgh was a center of the new scientific thought. His vision was a single law of all human knowledge, simple and unambiguous, a physical law which, in a sense, put him there at the basis of trying to explain the world and all its activities in physical terms. He was close to George and Adam Andrew Coombe, the phrenologists, the atheists, the materialists. Why publish the book anonymously? Well, first, he knew there'd be controversy, but he didn't expect much notice. He anticipated the negative responses. We know he gave away 200 copies to scientists even before it was published in order to get some circulation. He didn't do it directly in that no one except three people knew who the author was. The response, however, was excited, passionate, and violent. Four editions were published in the first 6 months, 10 editions in the first 10 years. The 11th edition was published after The Origin itself was published. In total, 23,750 copies of The Vestiges came into being. The Origin, in its first 10 years, published 9,500 copies. The theme, since there is nothing in inorganic nature which may not be accounted for by the agency of ordinary forces of nature, he wrote, let us consider the possibility of plants and animals having likewise been produced in a natural way. He proposes, therefore, a principle of progressive development as the simplest explanation, an explanation involving slow, gradual movement, such as we usually see in nature. This was his explanation. He was appealing to and allying himself with science instead of resting on a dogmatic assumption, he said, of ignorance. The evidence seemed to him to show that fauna were evolved through geological time and that the changes were slow and gradual, not correlated with any catastrophes in the environment. This was basically an update, a commentary on Lamarck, albeit it includes some critical remarks about Lamarck. And then he brought forward the evidence which was out there. Not that he, the author himself, claims to have found, because he was not a field naturalist or an experimentalist, but he turns to the geological and the fossil record. And he says, in the oldest strata, there are no organic remains. In the next strata, there are invertebrates, then fishes, as the only vertebrates, and then reptiles, and no birds, and then mammals, etc., working your way up through the strata of the geological remains. He saw the emergence of the more complex in each. In all the orders of animals, he said, there's a progression from the simple to the complex, the highest and most typical forms, he said, always being attained last. There was a fundamental unity of organization. All groups showed this, he said, as evidenced in comparative anatomy, as he went through the various classes of animals and compared what they had. He turned to von Baer's embryology, which showed embryos passing through stages similar to the stages of their primitive ancestors. Remember, ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny, as it was called later on. And then he turned to Andrew Cross's experiments, which suggested that spontaneous generation could account for the origin of life. It was a chemical-electrical process which produced globules. He applied the principles of uniformitarianism to the organic world, picking up the new geology of Charles Lyell. His evidence? He said, the evidence clearly show how all the various organic forms of the world are bound up in one, how a fundamental unity pervades and embraces them all, collecting them from the humblest lichen up to the highest mammifer in one system, the whole creation of which must have depended upon one law or one decree of the Almighty. God may have started it all, then nature and natural explanations and forces took over. What was he ready to see? Chambers, in a sense, was ready to cause a storm, and it was rapid and energetic. The first edition sold out at once. There were 3 reprints within 12 months, and 20 other editions followed until, well, it's still being reprinted for school use. There was an American edition, a German edition, all within the first few years. But the book was sold at railway, book, and newspaper stalls. It was sold at booths on the street corners. It appeared in circulation libraries, which appealed to artisan and middle-class readers. Hugh Miller, an opponent, author of Footprints of the Creator, put it this way: one can scarce travel by railway or in a steamboat or encounter a group of intelligent mechanics without finding traces of the ravages of the vestiges. Adam Sedgwick, the geologist, was blunt. I can see nothing but ruin and confusion in such creed. If current in society, it will undermine the moral and social fabric and inevitably will bring discord and deadly mischief in its train. And on this account, also, having a belief in the harmony of nature and an overruling providence, I believe it utterly untrue. Among its early critics, T.H. Huxley sharply criticized it in a review in 1854, and Benjamin Disraeli, that literary figure, prime minister, characterized the vestiges in his volume Tancred, a novelistic version. And he has the lady in Tancred urge her hero to read Revelations. You know, she says, all is development. The principle is perpetually going on. First there was nothing, then there was something. Then I forget the next. I think there were more shells and fishes. Then we came. Let me see. Did we come next? Never mind that. We came at last. And then the next change, there will be something very superior to us and something with wings. Ah, that's it. We were fishes, and then I believe we shall be crows. How would you say? Trying to demolish an argument through ridicule. But there were supporters. The reformist medical magazine Lancet called it a breath of fresh air to the workmen in the crowded factory. The ideas were now out in the open, beyond the timid group of the so-called scientific world, the coterie of the scientific world. We know the book was read by many, including the young Illinois lawyer, Abraham Lincoln. It was read by Herschel Lyell, Buckland Ewell, who were among its critics. Herbert Spencer, Alfred Munsell Wallace were positively impressed by it and supported it. Tennyson and Emerson were also impressed. Frances Power Cobb, the feminist reformer, recalls reading it at age 18 and pinning her faith to it. Florence Nightingale read the book. She said, I got up so high into vestiges that I could not go down again and was obliged to go off on an angel. Cedric was worried about the effect of this book on women. Many of the heavy of sciences were critical. Francis Bowen wrote a 50-page critique in the North American Review. He feared atheism. David Brewster, the physicist, in the North British Review, an insider, talked about it poisoning the fountains of science and sapping the foundations of religion. William Ewell wrote a whole pamphlet, Indications of the Creator, in 1845, and argues against transmutation science, which cannot deal with final causes. The mystery of creation is not within the range of her legitimate trajectory. John Herschel, in his presidential address to the British Association in 1845 in Cambridge, mocked this law of development. Crystals turning into living globules and polyps, fish and reptiles, and then up to man. Why? For aught we know, even to the angel. This was mere speculative law of development and cannot explain the amazing facts of geology. We must resort to elsewhere. Darwin, of course, was stunned by the response that he saw at the time. Alfred Russel Wallace read Chambers with excitement, and in a letter to a friend, his associate, Henry W. Bates, who traveled with him to the Amazon, he indicated the implications of the vestiges. "I do not consider it as a hasty generalization," Wallace wrote, "but rather as an ingenious hypothesis, strongly supported by some striking facts and analogies, but which remains to be proved by more facts and the additional light which future researchers may throw upon the subject. In all events, it furnishes a subject for every observer of nature to turn his attention to. Every fact he observes that must make either for it or against it, and thus it furnishes both an incitement to the collection of facts and an object to which to apply them when collected." Almost a prophecy of what Wallace himself was to do. The words were written in 1844 on reading the book. He set off for his explorations somewhat later. Wallace had a question on his mind when he headed for his researches in the Amazon basin. It was only after Chambers' death in 1871 that the identity of the anonymous author became fully known, officially known. Of course, it had been rumored for many years. In fact, for a long time, the rumored author was Charles Darwin. A question. If Charles Darwin had never lived or never gotten to publish The Origin, would we today be celebrating Wallaceism? That is, celebrating Alfred Russel Wallace? I'm serious. Wallace was born in Wales to a Scots family of the lower middle class. He had only 6 years of formal education. It ended at age 13. He was self and home educated, his father's books, the local library. At 14, he went to London to live with his older brother. He attended public lectures at the Hall of Science. He attended Owenite lectures, socialist lectures, and lectures of religious skepticism. He joined another brother as an apprentice surveyor. And in 1844, he became a master at school in Leicester, teaching English, arithmetic, surveying, elementary drawing, and he began wide reading. Alexander von Humboldt, T.R. Malthus, Robert Chambers, Charles Lyell, and Charles Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle. He delved into mesmerism and psychic research, into phrenology. He read George Coombe, The Constitution of Man. And in 1848, he began his voyaging. Initially with Henry W. Bates, collecting in the Amazon Basin, their hope was to sell their collections for support. The first trip was rich in what he saw and collected, but disastrous for support. The collections burned on a ship, board fire, shortly out of the mouth of the Amazon River. The trip in part was motivated by a desire to find support for Chambers' views. For Chambers' theses, that species arise through natural laws. He wrote articles and, of course, his book, A Narrative of Travels on the Amazon and Rio Negro, published in 1853. In 1854, he set out to explore and collect in the Malay Archipelago this series of islands, and island biogeography turned out to be important for him, as it was to turn out to be important for Darwin somewhat later. He spent 8 years in the Malay Archipelago, 14,000 miles of journeying, some 127,000 specimens. He published these and scientific papers in natural history, and then his important and well-known travel book, The Malay Archipelago. Very popular, well-received, and reprinted on many occasions. He was struck in his movement across the islands by geographical distribution. The difference between the eastern and western parts of the island, where you had a different fauna and flora. And from the Malay Archipelago, he sent back two papers. In 1855, on the law which has regulated the introduction of new species, and in 1858, on the tendency of varieties to depart indefinitely from the original type. In 1855, he believed he had solved... let me go backward on that one. He believed he had solved Lyell's problem, that is, how new species were initiated. He sent the paper that he wrote to Lyell. It was passed by Lyell to Charles Darwin as a potential mentor. Wallace had rejected Lyell's limits to variation, and he concluded that there was continuous slow change over very long periods of time. This in his first paper of 1855. Geography, he said, was the key. The most closely allied species are found, he wrote, in the same locality or in closely adjoining localities, and therefore the natural sequence of the species by affinity is also geographical. And then his law. Every species has come into existence coincident both in space and time with a pre-existing closely allied species. He kept a species notebook in which these and other items were put down. What he developed then was a theory of evolution by common descent, and it was empirically founded. Remember, 127,000 specimens. Darwin read the 1855 paper and, at his friend's urging, replied to Alfred Russel Wallace in positive form. He said he agreed with the truth of almost every word and that he was reaching similar conclusions and that he planned to publish a book in 2 years. And then there was the second paper of 1858. But wait, let me introduce another figure in the world before Darwin or before the origin. And that figure, of course, is the young Charles Darwin, before his 50th birthday. The question, of course, was Charles Darwin an accident? We know he had self-adapted a slow style of living. His entry into natural history, he told us, was due to an academic failure. He had an undistinguished school career at Shrewsbury. He gave up preparing for medicine in Edinburgh. He went to Cambridge to prepare for a religious career in the Church of England and took 10th place among those not seeking honors. He considered mathematics repugnant. He was poor at drawing and dissection and never mastered a foreign language. This was the portrait that Darwin really concocted of himself and allowed others to go on with. Yet he had good genes, both Darwinian genes, remember Erasmus and his own father, Dr. Robert, and he was a descendant of the Wedgwoods, another of those important Midland English manufacturing families. He had ill health, 5 seasick years aboard the Beagle. He was sheltered and sheltered himself from the public environment. He was nursed by his wife and dependent on her. He did not attend scientific meetings, and we know, he tells us, he lived a well-ordered existence. 4 hours of work each day, 2 walks in the gardens, 2 periods of rest on a sofa. He read a novel, smoked 1 cigarette, played 1 game of backgammon after dinner. He did not like poetry, music, good scenery. He was, as one commentator put it, an anesthetic man. He said of himself that his mind became a kind of machine for grinding general laws out of large collections of facts. Of course, this might not be exactly the way his life happened, but at age 22, he convinced his father, with the help of an uncle, Wedgwood, he convinced his father to let him take passage on the HMS Beagle. The Beagle, a 90-foot-long converted 10-gun brig. He was the unofficial naturalist. There was a more official figure. The boat sailed from Plymouth Sound on the 27th December of 1831. under the command of the 27-year-old Captain Robert Fitzroy. The boat returned to Falmouth on the 2nd of October in 1836. The ostensible mission was to survey the coast of Patagonia and Tierra del Fuego, Chile, Peru, and some Pacific islands, and further to carry a chain of chronometrical measurements around the world. Britain, after all, was a seafaring nation, a seafaring empire, and had developed and was strongly engaged in a tradition of exploration. We know that Darwin himself was worried. He confessed it in his diary. Was he prepared? I am often afraid, he wrote in his diary, I shall be quite overwhelmed with the number of subjects which I ought to take into hand. It is difficult to mark out any plan, and without method on shipboard, I am sure little will be done. The principal objects are first collecting, observing, and reading in all branches of natural history that I possibly can manage, observations in meteorology, French, Spanish, mathematics, and a little classics, perhaps not more than Greek Testament on Sundays. And he goes on, in a sense, the self-doubts of a 22-year-old who'd not done too well until then. Adam Sedgwick, the Cambridge zoologist, who Darwin had known as a student on walks together, sent along a copy of the first volume of Lyell's Principles of Geology. But he warned the young Darwin, don't believe the uniformitarianist theory put forward by Lyell. Darwin turned out to be a sharp observer of humans as well as nature. He talks about the slaves he saw and what it meant. And then the animals he saw. He notes an underground rodent with blind eyes, and he notes that Lamarck would have been delighted by this, seeing the loss of a feature by force of environment and disuse. He expressed an interest in the manner in which the characters of organisms change. And he compares fossils to living relationships, and he sees it troubling. He turns to South American birds. Here he is going around the southern tip of South America. He talked about seeing these South American birds. This small family of birds is one of those which, from its very relations to other families, although at present offering only difficulties to the naturalist, ultimately may assist in revealing the grand scheme common to the present and past ages on which organized beings have been created. Darwin is looking at the interactions of species with their environment. And, of course, there were the famous Galapagos birds and tortoises. When I recollect, he wrote in his ornithological notebooks, when I recollect the fact that from the form of the body, shape of the scale, and general size, the Spaniards can at once pronounce from which island any tortoise may have been brought, when I see these islands in sight of each other and possessed of but a scanty stock of animals, tenanted by these birds, but slightly differing structure, and filling the same place in nature, I must suspect they are only varieties. And if there is the slightest foundation for these views, the zoology of the archipelagos may well be worth examining, for such facts would undermine the stability of species. This is still while he's on board the Beagle. And he explores the relationship of the islands to the mainland alongside them. In his notebooks and diaries and letters, Darwin leaves a record of the steps taken in discovering evolution by natural selection. Scholars have worked them over. Janet Brown, who's here with us tonight in her stunning two-volume biography, The Crowning Achievement, brings Darwin together in a way no one had been able to do before. Darwin returned on October 1836, and in July 1837, he opened his first notebook on species, the red, the geology, the species, and on man. He combs the literature. In September 1838, he reads Malthus on population and population in relation to the means of subsistence. And what did he read in Malthus? He tells us what it was he saw there. Discussing the expansion of Shepherd's tribes, Malthus wrote, "And when they fell in with any tribes like their own, the contest was a struggle for existence, and they fought with desperate courage, inspired by the reflection that death was the punishment for defeat and life the price of victory." In his autobiography, Darwin told us that it once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones to be destroyed. The result would be the formation of new species. Here, then, I had at last got a theory with which to work. Russell Wallace, as I indicated, read Malthus and had very similar responses. Here we've seen natural selection in gestation 20 years apart. In Wallace, later, and Darwin first. Darwin's trajectory. Lived in London from 1837 to 1842, fully immersed in the species problem, and he began developing a series of alliances and began increasing his stature. In terms of his public science, he became a member of the Geological Society with the urging and the aid of Charles Lyell. He was elected at a particularly early age, a fellow of the Royal Society. He published the geological papers of the journal and the Journal of Researches of the Beagle in 1839. In his private science, he'd opened his species notebook in 1837, read Malthus in 1838, his theory to work by. And then he wrote in 1842 a sketch in which he spelled out his theory of evolution by natural selection. He didn't call it evolution. That word comes later. And in 1844, he wrote a longer version, his essay. And in July 5th, 1844, knowing what he's written and what it might mean, he writes to his wife, Emma, "My dear Emma, I've just finished," he calls it here, "my sketch of species theory." It's the essay. "If, as I believe, that my theory is true, and if it be accepted, even by one competent judge, it will be a considerable step in science. I therefore write this, in case of my sudden death, as my most solemn and last request, which I am sure you will consider the same as if legally entered into in any will, that you devote £400, a substantial amount of money in those days, to publication, and further will yourself or through Hensley Wedgwood, the nephew, take trouble in promoting it." And he goes on in a sense. Darwin knew what he found, knew what he had, wanted his wife to make sure it was going to be read and published. But why the delay? People have speculated on the delay, and I won't speculate further, except to say that it was clearly some mix of respect for his wife's deep religious beliefs, for he knew that his theory was challenging to religion, and in part the style of life he developed, wanting overwhelming evidence of what he'd found in order to make the point that he wanted to make. The style of life he developed was quite clearly that of what a pair of authors, Desmond and Moore, called a squarson, the squire parson, in the village of Downhouse in Kent, to which he'd moved in 1842. Darwin, in a sense, in those years, found his London patrons. He delivered papers, generally by mail, someone else reading them. He worked on coral reefs, on ocean coastal oscillation, empirical reports. He updated the Beagle materials. He was making a career of making the origin. And then, of course, in 1855 came the warning. Wallace's law, on the law which has regulated the introduction of a new species. Darwin in 1856 began what would have been the long version, at least twice as long as the origin itself. He thought he had time. Then in 1858, of course, somewhere in the June 3rd or 4th of that year, he got the letter from Wallace spelling out in some detail what Wallace had now produced. Darwin was frantic. "My dear Lyell," he writes to Charles Lyell, "some year or two ago you recommended to me to read a paper by Wallace in the Annals, which had interested you, and I was writing to him. I knew this would please him. He has sent me today the enclosed and asked me to forward it to you. It seems to be well worth reading. Your words have come true with a vengeance that I should be forestalled. You said this when I explained to you here very briefly my views on natural selection, depending on the struggle for existence. I never saw a more striking coincidence, he goes on. If Wallace had read my manuscript sketch, written out in 1842, we could not have made a better short abstract. Even his terms now stand as heads of my chapters. He was worried. With all my originality, whatever it may amount to will be smashed. Though in my book, if it will ever have any value, will not be deteriorated, as all the labor consists in the application of the theory. He was frightened that he was losing priority. Should he publish? I cannot persuade myself, he wrote, that I can do so honorably. He'd been warned off in this sense by Wallace. Can he now go ahead and say, in 1842, I wrote this earlier piece? Hooker and Lyell moved to publish, Darwin and Wallace simultaneously. And in the correspondence that lays behind it, and their correspondence with Wallace, they made very clear in their minds that Darwin had priority, that he had shared with them his views in the 1840s and later, and that the two papers should be published together, and the two men should both gain joint recognition. Wallace obliged. He was happy to go along with it. Referring to Hooker and Lyell, they moved to present the two papers to the Linnaean Society with a covering letter explaining Darwin's priority over Wallace, and putting the two papers in that order. And they were published July 1st, 1858. Neither Darwin nor Wallace, who was still in the melee, attended. But Darwin's priority was secured. After the frantic rush to bring out The Origin, a scaled-down version, The Origin was rushed into print in November of 1859. The reception. There are many, many things that have been said about the reception of The Origin. I'll share a few of them that I found interesting. First, a poem from the humor magazine Punch in 1861, caught something of the spirit in London of the day. The vestiges taught that all came from naught by development so-called progressive, that insects and worms assume higher forms by modification excessive. Then Darwin set forth in a book of much worth the importance of nature's selection, how the struggle for life is laudable strife and reflects in specific distinction. Am I satyr or man? Pray tell me who can, and settle my place in the scale, a man in ape's shape, or an anthropoid ape, or a monkey deprived of its tail. By any measure, the text of The Origin when published was strong. Like a legal brief, it spelled out the issues, massed the evidence, looked at any objections, and then went down through all the materials. One recent article in the New Yorker called it almost novelistic in the character and style of the prose. If you've read it, I'm not sure, at least I don't think of it quite novelistic in tone, although its tone is striking, it's moving, and it moves. We knew the reception was not going to be easy, Darwin could say on many occasions. The science was debated. Herschel complained to Lyell, as I have heard Charles Darwin complained to Lyell about Herschel. He said, I've heard roundabout channel that Herschel says my book is the law of higgledy-piggledy. He is evidently very contemptuous. If true, this is a great blow and a discouragement. Adam Sedgwick criticized the volume heartily. It gave him pain, and he would rather have seen Darwin not have written it. Charles Lyell, on the other hand, praised the close reasoning and the long-sustained argument, although he does worry about the case of man, What about humans in this? Man and his races and their relation to plants. Are they one and the same? And then, of course, there was Frederick Engels, the close friend of Karl Marx, who read the book shortly after publication in October and December of 1859 and writes to Marx, "The Darwin which I am reading," Engels says, "is really stupendous. Teleology, in one respect, had still been not finished off hither to it. It is now. Moreover, there has never yet been such a magnificent attempt made to demonstrate historical development in nature, or at least not so happily." Of course, you have to pass over the crude English method. The iconic confrontation came, of course, in Oxford at the British Association meeting in 1860, June 30, where the Bishop Wilberforce squared off against what would be the answer by Thomas Henry Huxley, who now had become a fierce proponent. He'd become Darwin's bulldog. The crowd was too large, had to be moved to a larger auditorium. The Athenaeum report, when published, talked about gentlewomen being present. Hooker and Huxley were there and gave Darwin a full account. Darwin was ill and not in attendance. Wilberforce presented, in his stunning rhetorical style, a well-formed critique of Darwin. It was little more than absurd guesses. He was worried by the inclusion of humans. It contradicts the revealed relation of the creation to the creator. He ridiculed the unsuspected cousinship of humans with mushrooms. Darwin, he says, is opposed to the interests of science and humanity. And then his peroration. And he turned to Huxley in the audience, looking him straight in the eye, and inquired whether it was on his grandfather's or his grandmother's side that he was descended from an ape. Huxley was said to have turned to his colleague at his side and said, "The Lord hath delivered him into my hands." Wilberforce, he felt, had gone over the line of a decent Victorian etiquette. Huxley, as he rose, defended Darwin, defended natural selection, not as a mere hypothesis, but as a fact. And then he concluded boldly, probably pompously, certainly controversially, in the words which he repeated to Darwin in his letter. "If then," said I, "the question is put to me, would I rather have a miserable ape for a grandfather or a man highly endowed by nature and possessed of great means and influence, and that to employ these faculties and that influence for the mere purpose of introducing ridicule into scientific discussion, I unhesitatingly affirm the preference for the ape." There was commotion in the audience. Lady Brewster fainted, a Victorian mode. Admiral Fitzroy of the Beagle was on his feet, shouting, protesting the origin and Huxley's defense of it. And with military bearing, in one account, he lifted an immense Bible first with both hands and then with one hand over his head, shouting, "Believe God rather than man." The debate continued through the decades. Science now was emerging more clearly as a professional activity, and in a sense, the amateurs were being pushed aside. Religious opposition continued, but in a sense, it became active mostly in a second track. By 1882, when Darwin died, there was a broad acceptance of the evolution by means of natural selection. There was, however, the mechanism. Lacking genetics, it was not yet there. Charles Darwin died on Wednesday, the 19th of April in 1882. Initially, the burial was scheduled to be at St. Mary's, the parish church in Down in Kent. But Francis Galton, Thomas Henry Huxley, Robert Hooker, John Lubbock had something else in mind. They would launch their last crusade for Charles Darwin. They wanted to move the burial to Westminster Abbey. A free thinker in the Abbey? The seat of the Church of England's orthodoxy? They collected important signatures. They had an editorial published in the Standard. They got the family to agree, to allow the burial in the Abbey. And 1 week after his death, on the 26th of April in 1882, at 12 o'clock precisely, the Abbey bells tolled. The procession with the coffin led by Canon Prothero went up the aisle. The choir sang, "I am the resurrection." From Proverbs declared, "Happy is the man that findeth wisdom and getteth understanding. Her ways are the ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace." The coffin was laid between the crypt of Sir John Herschel and the monument to Sir Isaac Newton. As the coffin was laid, the choir sang, "His body is buried in peace, but his name liveth evermore."